Good afternoon. A pleasant post-holiday Tuesday to you. This is Ozarks at Large for July 6th, 2021 on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's show, testing for COVID-19 at home. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, as cases are again on the rise in Arkansas, the use of over-the-counter COVID-19 home tests might be increasing as well. Her report begins in just a few minutes. And in our second half hour this afternoon, our militant grammarian, Catherine Shirls, explains some common phrases we use don't mean what they used to, like blood is thicker than water. That's later. After Ozarks today, Angeline Bulley tapped her Native American roots as she wrote her new young adult mystery novel. She'll tell us about the joys as well as hardships on the reservation. That, plus the latest on Elsa as the storm moves toward Florida. Here and Now begins at 1 this afternoon. Arkansas's cases of COVID-19 continue to rise. More than 1,200 new cases were diagnosed during the three-day holiday weekend, including 764 new cases reported on Saturday. There were 10 additional deaths from the virus counted since Friday. Hospitalizations since Friday have increased by 23 patients. And there is a net gain of more than 350 active cases since Friday, though active cases have dropped slightly the past 2 days of reporting. Arkansas has passed the million-shot vaccination level. More than 3,700 more Arkansans have become fully immunized since Friday. Governor Asa Hutchinson is scheduled to discuss COVID-19 in Arkansas later today. We'll provide an update on tonight's 7 p.m. edition of Ozarks at Large. And the governor says he doesn't think there will be a third surge of COVID-19 cases in the state. That's despite the low rate of COVID-19 vaccinations and a recent surge in cases because of the highly transmissible Delta variant. Speaking on CNN's State of the Union Sunday, the governor said the state is avoiding a third surge, but that's contingent upon more people getting vaccinated.
Well, I think our vaccination rate is sufficient that we can avoid the surge in hospitalizations that puts us in jeopardy, but that remains to be seen, and we are in a race, and if we stopped right here and we didn't get a greater percent of our population vaccinated, then we're going to have trouble in the next school year and over the winter. So we want to get ahead of that curve.
The governor says the state has done well at vaccinating higher risk populations and that the new surge in cases and hospitalizations is being driven primarily by younger, unvaccinated people. The governor says the state plans to work with large employers to help boost vaccination rates.
Obviously, the medical professionals are most trusted, but the employers have an opportunity to make it accessible for them, give them paid time off, the employees, they can go get vaccination, and to encourage them with the right level of education and information. Those are the kind of strategies that I think will make a difference in the coming days.
There are still more than 4,000 active cases of coronavirus in Arkansas. The state's tax surplus is over $945 million. The state's fiscal year ended June 30th with a $945.7 million revenue surplus. Part of that surplus is due to a tax filing deadline shift from April to July that meant some of fiscal 2020 income tax payments were shifted into 2021. The state's revenue tax surplus for the past two fiscal years is more than $1.3 billion. Peel Compton Foundation in Bentonville is updating the names of two of its original spaces. The Peel Mansion Museum and Heritage Gardens is now Peel Museum and Botanical Garden, and it's now Compton Gardens and Arboretum. The branding changes were announced in a press release. There are also new logos for the spaces. A former Arkansas Razorback basketball player will be playing for an NBA title beginning tonight. Bobby Portis, who was the SEC Player of the Year as an Arkansas Razorback for the 2014-15 college season, will be playing for the Milwaukee Bucks tonight as the team faces Phoenix in Game 1 of a best-of-seven series for the NBA championship. Portis is also a Little Rock native. Clear conditions tonight in northwest Arkansas, lows around 66. A few clouds expected tonight in the Arkansas River Valley with lows in the lower 70s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny throughout the region, though there is a 20% chance of scattered afternoon showers. Highs tomorrow from 88 to 93. Wednesday night's forecast includes a slight chance of rain, with lows from 67 to 73. This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us. Hope you had a pleasant holiday. COVID-19 home test kits are now widely available for purchase over the counter. But how do they work? And are they accurate? Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Dr. Jennifer Dillahay is state epidemiologist and medical director for immunizations and outbreak response at the Arkansas Department of Health. She says after a pandemic was declared 15 months ago, several SARS-CoV-2 tests were deployed.
There's one kind that looks for the genetic material of the virus, and those are called nucleic acid amplification tests, NAAT. And then there's the tests that look for protein that the virus has, and those are called antigen tests.
Nucleic acid amplification tests, NAT for short, also known as PCR tests. The first she mentions are highly sensitive, accurate medical lab tests sampled using nasal swabs or saliva. Rapid antigen or rapid diagnostic tests detect viral proteins known as antigens. An antigen test detects active infection, not the presence of COVID-19 antibodies. Antibody tests detect past infection. Rapid antigen tests are less accurate, but offer results quickly. Medical providers provide rapid testing, but at-home tests are now widely available for around $25 over the counter.
The antigen test looks for the proteins on the virus, and so you have to have a lot of virus present in the sample in order for the test to find the protein. So it's recommended for the antigen test that someone have symptoms. That's when they'll have most likely have the enough protein or enough viral particles there with enough protein in them for the test to pick up the presence of the virus.
Abbott Labs manufactures an FDA emergency use authorized at-home COVID-19 rapid antigen test, branded Binex Now, sold without a prescription by big box retailers and many pharmacies. The kit contains two antigen test containers, which are curved, two dropper bottles containing reagent solution, the test solution, and two nasal swabs. Early COVID-19 nasal swabs were inserted by medical providers up to 5 inches into the nasal cavity, causing great discomfort.
But now, an inch into your nose, and people can do it themselves. I mean, if they can pick their nose, they can do these tests.
Here's an Abbott video with a dramatic music bed explaining more about the Binex test.
Next, perform the test. Keep the card flat on the table. Insert the swab tip into the bottom hole. Firmly push the swab tip from the bottom hole until it is visible in the top hole. Do not remove the swab from the card. Turn swab to the right, clockwise, 3 times to mix the swab with the drops. Do not skip this step. Leave the swab in the card for the remainder of the test. Keep the card face up on your table. Wait 15 minutes. To check for a positive result, look at the result window carefully for 2 pink or purple lines. Make sure you look closely at the bottom half of the results window, where it says sample. Even a faint line next to sample is a positive result.
The test is conducted twice within 3 days with at least 36 hours between. Children as young as 2 can be tested by an adult. As for test results,
so it's a little bit like a pregnancy test. And if the test is working, it will have a line across the paper in the cartridge. It's a special kind of paper. That shows the test is working. And then if it's positive, the virus is present, another line will also show up.
Dillahay says positive test results require certain measures.
People should isolate themselves. That is if they're having symptoms, right? They should isolate themselves and let the local health department know that they have tested positive.
A search of Arkansas Department of Health units online will show all the county phone numbers.
The health department will need to record the case, and they'll also want to know who or that person may have exposed so that the person with COVID-19 can isolate the proper amount of time, but the people they may have exposed would be able to quarantine to prevent the spread.
According to Arkansas Department of Health data, new COVID-19 cases are again surging in Arkansas, the highest since last winter. Over 98% of current COVID-19 hospitalizations, which are also rising, involve people who are not vaccinated. Despite being widely available now and free, Arkansas ranks near the bottom of all 50 states for COVID-19 immunization. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The debate over how to teach racial matters in Arkansas continues. On Arkansas PBS, state legislators Mark Lowry and Joyce Elliott discuss the place of critical race theory in Arkansas classrooms. Representative Lowry, a Republican from Maumelle, proposed but failed to pass a bill banning the teaching of critical race theory, or CRT, during the most recent legislative session.
Well, CRT posits that America as a nation is currently systemically racist. Now, when you look at the definition of systemic, it's a medical term. It's talking about the entire organism. And I don't believe.
Lowry argues teaching critical race theory would promote racial division in classrooms. Senator Joyce Elliott, a Democrat from Little Rock, says she believes the teaching of critical race theory could help students understand the complex roots of racism in the United States.
When you say you want us to just concentrate on what brings us together, and that's true, but you can't get there unless you know what got us this point that we are divided, that we need to be brought together. And that's the thing we refuse to do. I wish we could have thoughtful, quiet discussions about systemic racism. And there is a thing such as systemic racism.
Both Lowry and Elliott are former educators and have worked on education committees or subcommittees in the Arkansas legislature. Just ahead on Ozarks at Large, the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra presents three events with renowned pianist and proud transgender woman Sarah Davis Buechner. Conversation coming up on today's show.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Opera in the Ozarks presents its 70th season, July 2nd through the 23rd, at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs. Nearly 20 performances will feature a cast of 35 vocalists and 13 orchestra musicians from across the nation. This season's operas include Massenet's Cendrillon and Donizetti's Lucia de Lammermoor, plus an abridged family version of Mozart's The Magic Flute. Tickets on sale now at opera.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra is presenting three events with renowned pianist and proud transgender woman Sarah Davis Buechner during a week-long July residency in Northwest Arkansas. Beginning July 16th, Buechner will appear at Walton Arts Center, The Momentary, and Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke via Zoom with Sarah, who was in Pennsylvania, and APO Music Director Stephen Bias, who was in Washington. To begin the conversation, Stephen discussed how the orchestra has prepared for a return to live performances.
This past year has been surreal for all of us, really, all of my colleagues in the United States, South America, Europe, Asia, have all wrestled with the same issues, and we've commiserated at every step because of the challenges of changing restrictions in different locales. But the bottom line is we have been restricted to either not performing at all or very limited. And the APO presented a program last October. We recorded it to be presented virtually with the Northwest Arkansas Ballet Theater, and a delightful program, but it was so strict and so challenging to do that. Everything else that's taken place for the APO, and in fact for most orchestras, has been small, as in chamber music, maybe a soloist with a pianist or piano recital, something like that, but it's been reduced greatly. So we are coming out of our skins with excitement about meeting in person to rehearse and perform, especially with a world-class artist like Sarah Buechner.
So a year at home gives you plenty of time to think about lots of things. So what are some of the factors that you considered when you were crafting and planning, you know, how you wanted to make this return to a more normal live performance with an audience?
Well, one of the great aspects, if I can call it a great aspect of being quarantined, was to have time that we usually don't have to think about the operation and the artistic presentations, the mission of what we do artistically and culturally, socially. And one of the great aspects of, I think, arts organizations' presentation is to embrace diversity, equity, and inclusion in an unprecedented way. There are many organizations that have done it all along. Many organizations make token efforts to move in that direction. But over the past year, the APO has thought very deeply about how we reflect what our mission, our stated mission is, and that is to reach the people in the community where they are. We have such a diverse community in Northwest Arkansas. It's really dynamic. When I try to describe the differences between Bentonville, Rogers, Springdale, and Fayetteville, they are four dramatically distinct communities, all with different needs and all different communities. So how can we possibly present a program that will possibly blanket the interests of all those people? Well, one of the things is to make the programs more personal, to have people meet the orchestra, have the orchestra meet and mingle with our patrons. And Sarah immediately came to mind. We worked together a few times in different places around the country, but she's one of the most dynamic, spectacular soloists, but also one of the most personable. That said, there are a few soloists who are dynamic and very talented and personable, but are not always articulate or charismatic. Well, Sarah is all those things packaged into one. And I'm talking about her while she's on this Zoom call. So I hope that I'm not embarrassing you, but it really is one of those rare opportunities where we have a chance in rebranding what the APO does to make a first impression. And you can only make a first impression one time. And I can't think of a better way than to create a program that where we're returning in person, but also to partner and collaborate with a soloist who is going to raise the level of what we do in every possible way. And that's Sarah Buchner. So we built a program after we invited Sarah to come, and she said, yes, I'd love to come. We built a program around what we thought would be appropriate with our reduced forces. You know, it's a complex recipe to come up with a program in the first place. But then thinking about the smaller orchestra that we're using, trying to be cautious and prudent in starting again in performing live for the first time after 18 months, this was what we came up with. And Sarah had some brilliant ideas. And Mozart, of course, I think that's one of the boldest things that I'll say. And it's easy to say anybody is a good or a great Mozart performer, but Sarah's the best. The very first time we worked together, I think, was with a Mozart concerto, and it was just divine. So I've been wanting to return to that. So we built a program starting with a Mozart concerto, and she had a suggestion of a rare, exceedingly rare work by Joaquin Turina that we'll perform. And I'd say the people in Arkansas are going to have an opportunity that probably 97-98% of the people in the United States will never have, because it's just that kind of rarity. But it's just one of the things that's de rigueur for Sarah Buchner. She just has this trunk full of gems that nobody else plays. So around that, I built a program I think is really interesting and nice, but it really is all centered and anchored with our wonderful soloist.
Are you blushing yet, Sarah?
I'm blushing all day. This man, you know, oh my God, he's made my job impossible. I'm going to be, you know, Superwoman and Wonder Woman and I don't know, an Aquaman all rolled into one or something like that. But I return all those compliments to Stephen, because he's equally articulate and brilliant on the podium, darn good looking too. And I just love working with Stephen. We've played in Mississippi and Portland, and I think that maybe another place as well. But everything that he said was true. You know, when we started to talk about that program, you know, I mentioned Mozart because you can do Mozart concertos with a reduced orchestra. But then I suggested that piece by Turina because it's for piano and strings. And so appropriate, I think the overall theme of all this is indeed kind of diversity and beauty and diversity. And I had the really, I have to call it a divine honor to have met the daughter of the composer Joaquin Turina in Madrid when I was playing concerts there. And I had recorded some of Turina's solo music. And she invited me to their beautiful house where Turina had lived till he passed away in 1949 and took me to the roof of their building where there was this stunning array of flowers, the most spectacular array of colors. And she explained to me that she had kept that garden exactly the same after her father had died. Because he loved to sit there with his cigar and his red wine and smoke. And I've always come to think of Turina's music as Spanish and colorful, just every color of the rainbow. And it's all in it. It's very, very beautiful, lush, romantic music, which I love dearly. So I was so happy that Stephen wanted to do that piece. And then he's put some other, you know, really wonderful things together. It's a very rare, he's right. It's a very rare program. You're not going to hear that from many orchestras around the United States. And I think it's also appropriate also, I mean, if we look back in the last year and a half, I mean, there's two major events have really throttled our attention here in the United States, one being that little bit of illness, and then the other being these, you know, this kind of sudden reawakening and awareness of disparities in our country and the fact that many people have challenges ahead of them that other people just don't have. And we witnessed this from the window of our apartment here, right in Philadelphia. It's, you know, it was like a real human outcry from the gut. You know, what responded to this verdict? You know, when it came out. So I think in regard to that, you know, I'm really, really touched that Stephen asked me as a transgender woman to come and not only to play the piano but also to speak a bit about my life in the arts. As someone who is, you know, I would say that I've faced hardships and challenges that perhaps other people have not. But I think more to the point is perhaps I have the ability then to speak of those things in a way that connects with anybody. You know, I mean, every human being has their challenges, their hardships, their walls to climb over and so forth. And I think we in the arts particularly feel this coming out of the pandemic, a certain maybe commitment to betterment of our social situation, because we can speak from the stage, whether it's in words, whether it's in music, whether it's through dance, through art, literature, painting, et cetera, how we respond to all these things, how we create and how we try to connect with other people is a large part of what we do. You know, we don't just sit on the stage and play music because it's fun to do. Of course, it's fun to do, but it has this deeper connection that's really at the heart of everything that we strive to achieve.
The transgender community throughout the country has had a rough couple of months considering the number of bills that have been passed, not just in Arkansas, but in other states as well, specifically targeting this group of people. So when you're having this concert, this motivational concert, this motivational conversation, how do you approach that? How do you offer motivation or hope, especially during a time when everything might seem very bleak?
Well, I think I'm lucky in the sense that when I walk onto a stage and I do what I do, I certainly have been told by other transgender people who come to hear me play, or GLBTQ, I mean, not just trans people, but they say to me, gee, I'm so glad you're out there doing what you do, because we look at you as a kind of, you know, kind of a role model. And if you can do it, okay, we can persevere and so forth. And that's something I'm very, very happy has developed and changed. You know, we can look at all the hardships and we can look at negative press and problems, sure. But trans people have come an awfully long way in terms of acceptance, understanding, and a lot more people know trans people now than they really used to. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, this word didn't exist. I had no information about, you know, I was sent to Freudian psychotherapists to straighten me out, you know. I mean, thank God we're a long, long way from this kind of thing. So, you know, you can't let yourself get depressed or overly angry at people who I think they're not thinking very much when they mindlessly seize on something as, well, maybe I'll get some votes if I attach myself to this kind of cause. You know, I have the feeling that when they get to know real trans people, then suddenly, you know, you meet people, you don't really feel like discriminating against them. Then that sort of, you know, so this is the best thing that I can do. The best thing that any trans person can do is just be visible. I mean, you know, come out wherever you are and show that we're a part of the human community. We are who we are. And we're here to not to demand extra civil rights or anything, but just to have a life like you and Aunt Sadie from Jersey City and anybody. And I stole that from a movie, by the way, that's Humphrey Bogart says that. Long story. I love that. Aunt Sadie from Jersey City. All I want is what Aunt Sadie from Jersey City has, you know, clams, day at the beach, et cetera, you know.
Absolutely. Since it is a residency and there are multiple components to this, you know, what do you hope that the public as a whole can take away from participating in one or all three events?
We start Sarah's residency with her musical performance. Really, it cannot be overstated what a caliber of soloist Sarah is. And when I've been fond of saying for decades that I don't have to sell music. I let music speak for itself. And when people come to see a performance and Sarah Buechner is performing, her artistry speaks for itself. It's immediate, it's touching. So just getting people to come and hear and experience this amazing and extraordinary musicality and artistry is number one. That's where we start. But because of the climate and because of the world conditions and in the state of Arkansas and other places, it's timely that Sarah come as a transgender role model and plant seeds in the community. Just as she said, it's difficult to discriminate against someone when you're in front of them and you realize there is nothing but a pure person of goodness. And now I'm speaking beyond the musical and artistic ideals. It's we want to reach our community where they are. And I know there's a large segment of our community. And in fact, all throughout the United States, I travel constantly and I see this everywhere I go, without exception, everywhere I go. There's always a portion of the community who needs something to which they can connect, to someone to whom they can connect. And by planting seeds, making Sarah available to tell her story, but also to let people know it is going to be okay. The possibilities are great. And look at the progress that we've made in the last 20 years, not nearly enough, but this is a good way for us to start. And it also pairs with what we're trying to do with the Arkansas Philharmonic and meet the community, all of the community, where they are.
That was pianist Sarah Davis Buechner and APO music director Stephen Bias. They spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda last week. Sarah's residency begins July 16th. Tickets for the event, two of which are free, are available now. More information is available at rphil.org. That's ARPHIL.org. And this is Ozarks at Large.
KUAF is supported by Hendricks College, offering engaged learning by linking classrooms to the world and developing career skills throughout its curriculum. Hendricks graduates pursue medical, law, and other advanced degrees, preparing students to lead lives of accomplishment. Hendricks.edu/connect for more information. The inaugural Ozark Beer Company Cardboard Regatta is July 25th at Lake Atalanta in Rogers. Teams and onlookers are invited to participate in the over-the-top spectacle. Prizes will be awarded. Proceeds benefit the Rogers Public Educational Foundation. OzarkBeerCompany.com/regatta for registration, rules, and more.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm pleased to have the Middleton grammarian Catherine Sherrills back with us inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
I'm pleased to be here. Our language is a rich one, Kyle, mm-hmm. What with borrowing from other languages and adding coined words all the time. But even with that rich source for expressing ourselves, we tend to use common sayings as shortcuts.
Sure.
However, it might surprise you and our listeners to learn that some of these well-known sayings don't mean what you think they do, or at least when they were first used. Kyle, if you wanted to tell your brother why you're doing him a favor, you might use an expression that means family above all else.
Blood is thicker than water.
Right. The original meaning of the phrase, however, is the exact opposite.
I know this much.
Did you?
It's biblical.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah.
Old Testament.
Yeah.
The blood of the covenant is thicker than the water of the womb, meaning shedding blood in battle creates a bond between soldiers that's actually stronger than familial bonds.
Yeah.
I know how much you love, hate hot weather.
Oh, I love hot weather. The other day I was walking and it was, for the first time this year, it was kind of muggy. And I was like, yes, we're going into the best time of year. Yes.
So if you were exclaiming how much you were perspiring, mm-hmm. you might say you were
sweating like a pig?
Yes. Yes.
And you're going to tell me they don't sweat?
They don't.
Yeah.
Did you know that or did you just assume it?
It makes sense. I mean,
the phrase has nothing to do with pigs. It refers to pig iron. You know pig iron? I don't know. I couldn't tell you anything more than it's a metal.
It's a metal, yeah, right, yeah.
Which is produced from iron ore during the smelting process.
And it then has,
when droplets of condensation begin forming on the metal surface, when the pig sweats, the metal is cool enough to be safely moved.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you can guess this one, Kyle. Mm. What does it mean to drop a dime on someone?
To snitch, to rat them out.
Mm-hmm, right. Usually referring to somebody calling the police to report on someone else's activities. Now, why would drop a dime mean calling the police?
Payphone.
Mm-hmm. Apparently originated in the 1950s when drop a dime literally meant to make a phone call by dropping a dime into a payphone. The phrase became popularized in detective novels of the era and eventually came to take on the more specific meaning of making a phone call to the cops to inform on somebody.
Yeah.
Kyle, what are you saying if you say to a friend, great minds think alike?
We had the same idea.
Mm-hmm. And as often the case, it originally meant the opposite.
Really?
Yeah. The original phrase was, great minds think alike, fools seldom differ. So it's not having a good idea, it's having a stupid idea.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Suggesting that smart people may reach the same conclusion, but so can stupid people.
Well, that's true.
I don't hear this one too often these days. Sounds like something my mom would have said. She might have been pleased as punch that I mentioned her on the radio. Got any guesses to its origin, Kyle?
Well, I'm going to guess it had something to do with Punch and Judy.
Very good. It has nothing to do with the noun or the verb, as in punt, hit somebody, or what you drink at a party. Punch and Judy puppet shows, Punch, or Pulcinello in the original Italian, was typically pleased with himself for all of his mischievous actions.
Mm-hmm. Although Punch and Judy traditionally had some violence in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, yeah. He carried a stick.
Yeah. If anyone out there is not quite sure what we're talking about, go to that great scene in Godfather Part 2 where they've got the festival going on and what's his name stops at the puppet show. That's Punch and Judy.
Huh.
And then Robert De Niro assassinates him.
No.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
I didn't know, but I figured.
You've seen Godfather Part 2.
Yeah,
though.
But it's been years. I loved Godfather, and I recognize that it's wonderful movie making. I just don't watch it every time it's on. This next one may have its origin in a similar violent activity.
Okay.
Kyle, what does rule of thumb mean?
Is it a measurement?
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm. So if you say that's...
I know what rule of thumb
is. Okay, what
does
that mean?
Rule of thumb is that, like, that's the common assumed...
Past experience to simplify something.
Right. I was going for the origin. I thought maybe...
Yeah, okay. Well, one common belief traces the phrase back to the 1700s England, where a man was allowed to beat his wife, but only with a stick that was no thicker than the circumference of his thumb. Don't want to use that phrase now?
No. Lord.
This, however, has been disproven.
Oh, good.
But no one knows what the origin is.
well, who was the jerk who invented the not real reason or origin?
Well,
yeah, okay. Yeah.
This is a little unrelated, but something I learned in law school debunks what lots of people say about the First Amendment. They say, well, it's first for a reason. And while it is the basis for many of our other rights, when the Bill of Rights was written, it was third. Good bar bet, by the way.
Yeah.
It was, however, the first of the amendments to be ratified.
Okay. Help me out again. Mm-hmm. So it was the third to be written
into the Bill of Rights.
But it was the first to be ratified.
So it became the first.
So it moved up. Yeah. I got you.
The original First Amendment stated a formula for determining the size of the House of Representatives based on the population of the United States in 1789. That amendment could still be revived, but it wouldn't be practical in modern times.
No.
Yeah, because the population's so different. The original Second Amendment was about determining when Congress can change its pay. It took a very long time, but the original Second Amendment became the 27th Amendment when it was ratified in 1992. Did you know that one? Did you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then, of course, now we know the Second Amendment deals with
guns,
weaponry, right, guns. Right.
Okay, so that's a little law trivia.
I like it. Our Middleton grammarian is Catherine Charles. This is Ozarks at Large. The Alamo is a part of American history with a large legendary status. But as is often the case, the history and the legend don't always align. The new book, Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth, is an examination of the events that led up to the battle and the rise of the legend surrounding the Alamo since. The book is written by three authors, Brian Burrow, Jason Stanford, and Chris Tomlinson. We reached Chris Tomlinson, a columnist for the Houston Chronicle and the San Antonio Express News, recently to ask him about the book. He says the most often told stories surrounding the Alamo don't touch on the role slavery played in the origins of the battle. And he says the legends, true or not, hold a special place in Texas lore.
Texas has a law that every school teacher must say the people who died at the Alamo were heroic. It is the origin myth of our state. And, you know, Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, and William Travis are the holy trinity of the Texas revolt and the Alamo story. So, no, I think it's quite intentional that you only learn the thin veneer of who these men really were.
Before we talk about the men, let's talk about the battle itself, because it is commemorated as a fight for Texas independence. But as we learn through history, with many things, there's much more to the origin of the battle than just Texas independence.
Well, there are 15 years of politics, Mexican and Texan politics, that preceded the battle. Mexico won its independence from Spain. They wrote a constitution barring slavery at a time when Anglos were bringing slaves from the Old South into Texas to grow cotton. And there's this 10 years of politics back and forth where Stephen F. Austin is saying, we must have slavery. We must have our slaves or we can't make any money. And it was only when it became clear that Santa Anna had seized control of the Mexican government, established a dictatorship, and said that he was going to ban slavery that we see the Texans take up their arms. And so while there are many causes for the Texas Revolt, the underlying one was slavery. And we're just not taught that in school. And it's time we have to face up to that.
In fact, Jim Bowie had a career as a slave trader.
I mean, Jim Bowie was such a fascinating character. He was a land swindler in Louisiana and Arkansas. He fled to Texas to escape federal prosecution. And he would take slaves from the pirates Lafitte, Jean Lafitte in Galveston, who he was importing them from Cuba illegally. Bowie would take them across the border into Louisiana and then eventually kind of switch his hat and become a state revenuer and then seize the slaves for being illegally brought into the United States and be allowed to sell them and make a profit. He was an amazing con man, but he was always just two steps ahead of the law until he got to Texas.
Now, you also mentioned, you know, the Holy Trinity and Davy Crockett, one of them. Davy Crockett's reputation is that of an amazing frontiersman, and it's a spotless reputation, right?
Well, that's what Walt Disney tried to convince America to believe in the 1950s with his miniseries, and a lot of people still believe the Disney version of Davy Crockett. But Disney was looking to make a Cold War film to kind of build American patriotism. You look at the real Davy Crockett, and, you know, he was a bit of a frontiersman. He did not kill a bar when he was five. He was a politician from Tennessee, a congressman. He went to Washington, had a falling out with Andrew Jackson and the Whigs, and he fled to Texas humiliated. They made Broadway plays mocking him. And he disappeared from history until Disney comes along and resurrects him. Prior to 1940, he was nothing more than a footnote in most American history books.
You know, There have been many discussions about statues of Robert E. Lee and other Confederate figures. We're having a discussion in Fayetteville, Arkansas right now about Senator J. William Fulbright, who signed the Southern Manifesto, and whether a statue should remain where it is on the campus of the University of Arkansas. There are many statues of these men involved in the Alamo. There are schools named after them. But there has not been, to my knowledge, much of a pushback against them. Or their namesakes on buildings or statues?
You know, it's just beginning in Texas. And we saw some of it last year as we were wrapping up the book. We saw people begin to say, we need to be honest about the fact that Travis and Bowie were slave traders. We need to be honest about the proximate and the fundamental causes of the revolt. So in Texas, we're not naming people after those folks anymore. And while I don't think we should judge those individuals by their actions 180 years ago, we need to judge ourselves by who we choose to honor, who we choose to put up on those pedestals. And one of the things that too often is forgotten is that when you honor a slave trader, when you honor a swindler, and you ignore the contributions of Tejanos and Mexican Americans to the state's history, you're sending a signal. You're sending a signal of white supremacy. And that's what we really need to address. And I think we're just beginning to have that debate around the Texas Revolution.
Earlier this year, we had Karen Cox, author of the book No Common Ground, on the air. And in that book, she traces the history that many of the Confederate statues that dotted the southern landscape were pushed by daughters of the Confederacy, women who would raise money and project the myth of white supremacy. There's a similar sort of buildup in the Alamo mythology, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, when women were not allowed to vote and when they were not allowed to hold office, the way they participated in politics was to join these heritage societies like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, like the Daughters of the American Revolution. And here we have the Daughters of the Republic of Texas, the DRT. And women were often members of multiple groups. And they asserted themselves in determining what monuments were built, who was remembered. They had a key role in writing of the textbooks and what was taught in school. And so we have several chapters in our book about the role women in the late 19th and early 20th century played in creating and perpetuating these myths and deciding who we honor and who we don't.
Chris Tomlinson is my guest. We're talking about a book he helped write with Brian Burroughs and Jason Stanford called Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. You mentioned earlier in our conversation the Tejanos. There were Tejanos who fought alongside the Anglo rebels at the Alamo. What can you tell me about them?
Well, the Tejanos were here first, obviously. Mm-hmm. They are the descendants of Spaniards and indigenous people, and they were in San Antonio. There were a few thousand of them when the first Anglo arrived and began to settle here. And for the most part, they were very independent-minded. They believed in democracy. They believed in federalism, but they believed in Mexican federalism. They wanted to be part of Mexico. And so when Santa Anna seized power and he started suspending the Constitution, the Tejanos were the first ones to stand up and say, we have to fight. We have to fight for our rights. We have to fight for federalism. We have to fight for the Constitution. Anglos really weren't interested at first. And then when the Anglos found out that, oh, wow, these guys are going to take away the our right to hold slaves, that's when they joined the Tejanos in fighting against Santa Anna. And then they co-opted that movement to declare independence. Texas did not declare independence until several days into the Battle of the Alamo, into the siege of the Alamo. And as a result, a lot of Tejanos died thinking they were fighting to save Mexico instead of making Texas independent.
Okay, look, the Alamo is connected to John Wayne, as you mentioned, Walt Disney, even Pee Wee Herman, right? I mean, it's part of the American story. You're in Texas. What's the reaction when people read the book? I'm imagining there is some disappointment and some rejection to know the real history.
Well, you know, the trolls are alive and well on social media. We've just given them a big dose of adrenaline to come after us. And yes, there are a lot of traditionalists and nativists and people whose identities are tied up in this myth. And they're quite angry and they're denouncing us. But there's also a segment of Texas society, the Chicano, the Mexican-American, the Tejano, who, when I was a kid, I had friends who would punch Mexican kids in the arm and say, remember the Alamo, oh, every time they saw that kid. You know, we talk to these San Antonians whose families go back eight generations, and they talk about the humiliation of going to the Alamo in seventh grade and discovering that they're not quite American enough, they're not quite Texan enough, and that they're responsible for Davy Crockett's death. And so their stories need to be told. They need to be fit into this narrative, and that's what we're trying to do.
I'm wondering, was there anything about the Alamo or the politics that led up to it that you couldn't find out, any holy grail of history that just eludes us?
Well, I think almost everything we know about the battle, you know, if you go visit the Alamo, people talk about, oh, this is where Travis died, and this is where Bowie died, and this is where Crockett's men fought. But all of that is based on, you know, primarily on two accounts. One of Susanna Dickinson, the only Anglo survivor of the battle, who was Santa Anna sent to Sam Houston to say, hey, everyone's dead and you're next. And also Travis's slave, Joe. But, you know, these people were not interviewed by historians. They weren't interviewed by journalists. Their stories were filtered through Sam Houston and his officers. And so, you know, people make a lot of assumptions about what they know about the Alamo based on these carefully filtered accounts. And so, you know, we know from the Mexican accounts that it lasted 45 minutes, but that's about it, because the Mexicans didn't see it as a major battle. They just saw it as a skirmish.
Anything I've neglected to ask or you'd like to add?
I would just say this is a book for everyone. It's intentionally lighthearted. It's funny. It's designed to be a pleasant read. It's not a heavy textbook, and we just hope it'll appeal to everyone.
Chris Tomlinson is one of the authors of Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. Chris, thank you so much for your time.
So, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Our conversation with Chris Tomlinson, one of the three authors of Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth, was recorded
last month. This is a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Today, alongside Robert Ginsberg, of course, the longtime host of Shades of Jazz, which can be heard on KUAF. He's also executive director of the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society. Robert, always nice to talk to you.
Pete, it's great to be in the same room with you.
It's just things are better. Things
better,
are better.
Much better.
Well, if we're talking to you, we're going to be talking about, of course, the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series, which has now been going on for how long?
22 years, Pete. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society has been presenting this for 22 years, as the KUAF is our primary sponsor and partner in it from the very beginning. And away we go. We had to cancel everything last year, so we're rolling. And it's an interesting season, Pete, because we've always collaborated with KUAF, but this year it seems like we are doing a lot of curatorial collaborations with other organizations. So our next event is July the 10th. And we've done this once before with Crystal Bridges. They have their North Forest Concert Series, and we're curating this next concert there.
That's July 10. Who's it going to feature?
It's going to be an evening of Latin and Brazilian jazz, so it should really be fun out in the North Forest. We have a regional group called Los Valeros. William Reyes is a guitarist who leads this group. Alicia Patillo is a saxophonist. She's in it as well. Benji Wilson's the bass player. Darren Novotny and Fernando Valencia, two percussionists. Okay. And they do a blend of Latin jazz and some bossa nova, some Brazilian music as well. And it's really laid back, outdoor, kind of lay in a hammock and drink a margarita kind of music. It's a lot of fun.
Somebody want to know more about this, more about the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society, digjazz.com, I guess.
Digjazz.com. And Pete, we are right literally on the cusp of launching an entirely new website. Our site is up, but in a week or maybe 2 weeks, we're going to have a brand new look, a new logo, and that's all going to hit in a couple of weeks. And I'm always happy to hear from people at my email, robert@digjazz.com.
Robert Ginsberg, executive director of the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society and host of the long-running Shades of Jazz, with you can listen to this Friday night at 10 p.m. Robert, good to see you.
Likewise, Pete. Thanks.
The Community Spotlight and KUAF, Local Matters.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Caverna, Missouri. KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Contributors to our show today included Jacqueline Froelich, Antoinette Grajeda, and our militant grammarian, Catherine Schurls. Additional content today provided by the news staff at KUAR, public radio in Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our thanks also to Talk Business and Politics for assistance with today's show. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find out more about him at his Facebook and Instagram feeds. Daryl, still doing some live concerts, including taking requests at around 4 o'clock each weekday afternoon at his Facebook and Instagram feeds. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. I'm Kyle Kellums. We will return with a new show tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. We're always around at OzarksAtLarge.com. You can find individual stories, interviews, and full shows there. You can also listen to us completely on your schedule for free when you subscribe to the podcast version of Daily Ozarks at Large. That's available either through free subscription at KUAF.com or by going to your preferred major podcast distributors. Thanks so much for being with us. Hope you had a great holiday. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Please take care of yourself.